Okay, so before the midterm, which seems like a long time ago, we talked about set associativity and then how to handle rights. Rights require a little bit of extra work because on a miss, you have to decide whether to allocate an entry in the cache and fill in the cache line that you missed on. And of course, then you have to observe your replacement policy like LRU. And separately, you have to decide whether new data that you write into the cache, if it's write allocate, only stay in the cache or immediately get sent all the way out to main memory. And there are pros and cons to both approaches, but if you use the write back approach, then when that cache line is later going to be evicted by some other replacement, it holds the only copy of the newly written data. We call that cache line dirty, and so we have to actually copy that data out. Whereas for data that are not dirty, so data that has only been read, or in the write-through case, then that data in the cache is not newer than what's in memory. And we don't have to actually spend the time to write the cache line entry back to memory. We can just drop those bits on the floor. So we'll pick up from there and look at a couple of exercises, but just a couple of administrative notes. For the lab tomorrow, remember that it is in person. So no online submission. So you need to attend, preferably attend your assigned lecture since we expect the labs to be full. There's not going to be a lot of spare capacity in most cases. And remember that your page table 2 is due before lab. So there's no 90% late grace period like we have with other assignments. You have to submit it before lab because then you're going to get code review and you're going to be able to improve your submission. So if there is something that is preventing you from attending lab tomorrow, please do let us know before the lab, and we'll see what kind of arrangements we can make. And then midterm scores have been published. You should have gotten an email. You should be able to go into the course website, submission site, and see your raw score and your scaled score. And that scaled score is something that Professor and Rice came up with to account for the way that the exam was challenging. And I'm not going to answer any other questions about the midterm right now because we do still have a few people who need to do makeup exams. So once those are all done, then we can talk more about the midterm. All right, so let's start off. And I'm going to make you guys work. And this should look very familiar from the examples that we've done before. So for each of the following accesses, work on your own or work with a neighbor and see if you can deduce whether it would require reading a value from memory or if we have a multi-level cache from whatever the next level is, and whether it would result in writing a value back to memory versus just throwing the bits away for these three cases. So for each of these three cases, they're performed alone. It's not like they're consecutive. So cache starts in that state, you write a byte to 0x33. Then cache starts in that state again, and you write a byte to 0x52, and so on. So this is a chance to refresh some material that we haven't looked at super recently. Okay, so maybe let's see how this looks. And by the way, I forgot to mention, for your page table 2 assignment, it's due before the first lab of the day on Wednesday, not before your individual section. Just wanted to clarify that. All right. So when we write a byte to 0x33, this is going to be a hit, right? Because that address is already in the cache. And if you work out the split the address into the appropriate bits, since we have just 2 sets, just the low order bit is going to tell you the byte. And since we said that, I guess it's not actually on here, but it's clear from the slide, we have just 2 bytes per cache line. So the low order bit is your offset, then the next bit is your index, and 0x33 is going to have an offset of 1. It's going to be in set 1, and then of course, it could be in either way. It happens to be resident over here in way 1, and it's a hit. And in fact, this is already marked dirty, so we don't even have to change the dirty bit. And let's see, was it dirty in the original setup? Yes. We do have to change the least recently used way to be this way, way 0. Because we're modifying way 1 by writing to it. So it is no longer the least recently used way. So the LRU is telling you which way, in this notation here, the LRU is telling you which way is the one that has been least recently used. Everyone with me so far? No, no, that's an important question. You might think that you need, when you overwrite a value in the cache, that you want to push that older value out to memory. But we're never going to use that older value. We have written a new value, and that is now the globally visible value. The time when we need to do a write back to memory is when we're flushing this out of the cache so that our newly written value gets put in memory as opposed to just going poof and getting lost. Okay, so now when we read a byte from 0x52, the fact that it's 2 here means that we're going to be at offset 0. That's the less important part of this address for this example. It also maps to set 1. And remember, we started out, we're doing each of these as if we're doing them alone. So we start out with the LRU here being 1, meaning that this here is our LRU way. So when we do 0x52, we're going to go to set 1 here, we're going to miss, there's no 0x52 in here, so we're going to pick the LRU way, which is the one that I outlined, and we're going to replace that. We're going to replace a line that is dirty. So we have to actually write the contents of this cache line out to memory before we can fill in the contents from memory for 0x52 to 53. Everyone see that? Any questions? So then again, well, here we show it on the slide. So now for reading a byte from 0x50, we're going to be in set 0. And so we're going to be over here. And we have to replace something. The LRU is 0. So this will be the way that we replace. This is not dirty, so we can just throw those bits on the floor, no write back, and immediately place this cache line with the contents for 0x50 to 51, as shown here. Any questions? Yeah.
Just to clarify, for the writing one bytes is 0x33. So the reason that was not written to memory is because nothing was replaced.
Correct, because it's a hit. The only thing we do is change the LRU, because now that's the most recently touched way. So for exercise two, it's exactly the same, except we're doing write through. So you'll notice here that we no longer have a dirty bit, because we don't have a concept of a dirty line where the values are only present in cache and have not been written out to memory. So go through the example again. Should be a little faster for the write-through case. Maybe just do the first one or two, just to satisfy yourself that you're comfortable with this. I mean, we can do the first one very quickly, right? 0x32, it's a hit. We have to write the value out to memory because it is a write-through cache. We're done. And we do change the LRU value to zero. And so you see that here. For reading a byte from 0x52, that is going to replace this, just like before. And we don't need to do a write back in this case, because it's not dirty, because it's write through, and that earlier write that we did was already propagated to memory earlier. And for reading from 0x50, it's just the same as before, because it was a read and there's nothing dirty. Any questions? All right. Now, writing bits to memory takes a non-trivial amount of time, even if you're just going out to another layer of cache that's farther away from the processor, it still takes many cycles while you're waiting around to bring in the data that the load has requested. With a write back or a store that's being written through, there's typically no subsequent operation in the program that's immediately reading that value. There are exceptions, like in function call protocols. So this isn't a blanket statement. But in general, stores are not super latency critical. Loads are the ones that are latency critical because the program's waiting around for that value to be placed in the register. And that means that we'd like to have a way to make stores or the writebacks be faster. And so what we can do is we can have an extra hardware structure called a write buffer, or sometimes called a store buffer, where you put the values that are going out to the next level, whether it's another layer of cache or memory, and it's made from the same sort of high-speed cache transistors as the current cache level. So putting the values in the write buffer is just as fast as writing them into this particular cache. And now you've preserved those store values, and they can be sent out to memory as soon as the memory, or next level in your memory hierarchy, as soon as it's idle. And now that you've saved them kind of in a temp location, you can go ahead and bring in the data that you're loading and satisfy the load and reduce the latency of that load and make your program run faster. The only catch is, even though the write appears to be complete immediately, and you don't have to worry further, You do have to check on every cache miss whether the value you're looking for is in the write buffer. Because if you have the most recently written value in the write buffer and you forget to look there and you go out to memory to fetch that address, you will fetch stale data. Everyone see that? All right. So let's talk a little bit about cache design. And many, many papers were written about this in the 80s and 90s, especially the 90s, until it was regarded as somewhat of a solved problem, although there are still there's still research on making caches more efficient. But at a basic level, there are some behavior patterns that are really hard to deal with. And here's a good example. If you want to make a cache look bad, access enough blocks to fill the cache, then access one more block at a different address, which is going to, of course, cause something to be replaced. Then you keep accessing the whatever block just got kicked out of the cache. Or variations of this pattern where, let's say you have a cache with n blocks and you want to access n plus one values. And you have, let's say, a a fully associative cache with LRU. The least recently used is actually always going to be the next plus one address you want, and it's always the one that's getting evicted. So there are these sort of pathological, we call them, access patterns that just either by bad luck or maybe by malicious intent cause the particular cache architecture to give a long sequence of misses. Now this, I say malicious because this can also be used to try to infer what addresses have been actually accessed recently by determining whether something is a hit or a miss. And we're going to talk about that at the end of the semester. And these are so-called side channel attacks. For now, we're just worried about trying to make the cache give good performance. And this is an uncommon scenario. We typically don't encounter this because real programs have locality. You just sometimes get unlucky that the software data structure that you're working with is not fitting cleanly in the cache. So if you analyze your, as a hardware designer, if you analyze your customers' representative workloads, so like if you're Intel, you're going to care a lot about big businesses that buy a lot of your processors and what kind of workloads those customers run and what will make their programs run fast enough compared to the previous generation that it makes these buyers want to buy the next generation of processor. And so what kind of things can you do to make the cache better? Well, you can make it larger, but that makes it slower. You can keep it the same size and you can increase the associativity. That will also reduce the miss rate, but that will also make the cache slower. So often what we'll have is a first level cache that is optimized for speed, then a second level cache, and maybe even third level or fourth level has been done that is optimized for both capacity and hit rate. So it's very large and it's very high associativity. So that way we can sort of balance for cases where you have a lot of really tight locality, you should get L1 hits, and they'll be really fast. So the L1 will typically not be more than about 64 kilobytes, and it will not be super high associativity. Maybe it'll be 8-way associative. The L2 and L3 will be larger. L3s these days are 32 gigabytes or more, and have very high associativity, and there are other tricks they play to make these larger caches efficient. And basically what we're trying to balance here in each of these levels is balancing the hit rate versus the hit latency, and another drawback of having deeper and deeper caches where each layer of the cache is larger is that the more layers of cache you have to traverse on a miss, the longer the latency is to finally fill that miss. So let's say you have a four levels of cache and you miss through L1, then L2, then L3, then L4. You're incurring the cost of four cache lookups before you finally get around to fetching the data from memory. And so you don't want to make your cache hierarchy arbitrarily deep for this reason. And in analyzing this, there's no single design that is going to be universally good. You're also going to want to account for the way that different programs behave. So how often is the same block used again? When there are conflict misses, what do the patterns look like? Maybe that leads to a redesign of your cache replacement policy. How big should your cache blocks be? A longer cache block will be good when you're streaming through an array, because even if you miss on the first item in that cache block, the longer the cache block, the more subsequent array elements will be cache hits. But for a fixed size cache, really big cache blocks mean you have fewer sets. And these are typically evaluated in the hardware design world through simulation. So here's some representative data. These are from an older benchmark suite, but they're illustrative. With a 64-byte block size LRU replacement, varying the cache size and the associativity. And you get a sense here of how much doubling the cache size versus increasing the associativity affects your cache miss rate on, admittedly here, some older applications. But these applications range from scientific computing to things like GCC, the compiler, used as a benchmark to test what kind of cache miss rate it has. I think Spec 2000 also had the Go game as one of the benchmarks, and a traffic simulation, and so on. So when you average across all these benchmarks, with a 1K direct mapped, let's say you get 8.6% miss rate. You can double the size, or you can double the associativity. Turns out that doubling the size is better for you because the miss rate goes down more that way. If we look at, let's say, a 64K cache, and we double the size versus doubling the associativity, we see a similar relationship. So doubling the size is going to give you more places that you can put data. Doubling the associativity doesn't actually increase the number of places that you have in the cache. It doesn't increase the capacity. It simply reduces conflict misses, where you get unlucky and two accesses map to the same location. So when you think about it that way, it's actually pretty impressive that doubling the associativity from direct map to two-way gets you a miss rate that's pretty close to doubling the capacity. And so this is just meant to sort of illustrate the kind of data that you might analyze if you're trying to choose a cache design. So we've talked about capacity and conflict misses and associativity. We haven't really talked much about what to do when you have cold misses or compulsory misses, which, as you might recall, are when you take a miss because it's the first time you're ever touching this data while this process is running. So without prefetching, I'm giving away the punchline here, you can't avoid a miss if it's the first time you're touching some address. However, if you know that you're going to touch that address fairly soon in the future, you could bring it in ahead of when it's needed so that it's already in the cache when you actually try to do a load from that address, and now you turn it into a hit. Or at least you may reduce the latency for bringing that data in because you've already initiated the fill. So what prefetching can be done either in hardware, where hardware can detect a pattern of accesses, or in software, where the compiler recognizes that there's a pattern and can sort of plan ahead. So all modern processors now include some hardware prefetching for streams where you have an access pattern like this. And I'm sure you can see what the pattern is. How many people think the next address will be 0x48050? Hopefully everybody's hands are going up, right? Because that's just the stride that we're walking through here. Hardware can recognize that super easily for a regular stride. And this is a common pattern. Sequential striding is a common pattern with instruction fetch and many array accesses. And then many other algorithms will have some other fixed stride, where maybe they're skipping by chunks of two or four or whatever. And so that seems like a clear win, but you don't want to prefetch too much because anything you prefetch has to be stored somewhere. You can directly put it into the cache at the appropriate location, which will evict something else. And if you don't time the prefetch right, or if you prefetch too much, you might evict data that the program wants to use before it gets around to the data that you've actually prefetched. So the hardware designers have to do some very fine balancing here. And so, for example, I think Intel's solution for this is they have these stream prefetchers. They'll prefetch a certain number of elements ahead that's based on what they expect the miss latency to be, and they don't put them in the L1. They put them in the L2. So then when you touch that address, you'll still take an L1 miss, but you'll only go to L2, which is like maybe a 10-cycle latency instead of 40 or 50 to L3, or a couple hundred cycles to go all the way out to main memory. Okay, so any questions about this? So I'm gonna actually go back to virtual memory and address translation here. So we're changing gears. Remember, this is what a typical two-level page table walk might look like. We take the virtual page number, break it up into two pieces. The first piece looks in a first-level page table. That gives us the address of the second-level page table that corresponds to that page number. We then go to that entry, and then that finally gives us the physical, that second-level page table entry will give us this physical page number that we need. So it looks like this. And the problem with this is that if we have to do this on every virtual memory access, it's really expensive. And if we go to four-level page tables, like modern Intel processors, or five levels, which some newer generation processors are doing, we're going to have a very large number of accesses just to do the translation. We've got to look in the first level page table, second level page table, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, before we finally even get to look at the address that we ultimately want. Now, maybe we have a tight loop and we're only accessing a small amount of data, and all of these page tables are in our L1 or at least our L2 cache, But still, even imagine that we had a big enough L1 and a small enough working set. If we have to do a four-level page table walk, which means five cache accesses to actually get the data that we want, that is five consecutive clock cycles just on every load or store. Or remember, we have to do this for instruction fetches too. So every instruction we fetch, we need to take the instruction address, the program counter, that's just a virtual address, and we need to do this. So if we needed to spend five or more cycles on every memory access, this would be very costly. So, and this is making a lot of ideal assumptions, that the L1 is a single cycle hit, that there's no other work that needs to be done between successive page table accesses, but we know there is, right? Because you have to pick apart the page table entry. So we can leverage the fact that we typically are only accessing small regions of our address space at any given point in time. And that working set of pages that we're touching changes very slowly. So we might be using a small portion of our code. You know, we're executing away in some loop in a function, and maybe a little bit of data from the heap. And we're, of course, going to have some local variables on the stack. In many cases, that's not so many pages that we're actually working with over some useful duration of time. Whenever we have a small working set out of a large possible set of accessible things, we can use a cache. So that's exactly what caches are based on, is that we're working with a small amount of data, and rather than go all the way out to expensive DRAM and spend 100 plus cycles on every load and store just to access DRAM, we can keep our working set of data in a much faster cache. Well, we can do the same thing for the page tables, and instead of actually keeping them in the cache, we can have a special structure for these. So page table entries have excellent temporal locality. That's what I'm describing here when we're using a small amount of stuff for a period of time. And we don't want to use a general cache for this, because actually we want the TLB to be faster than the cache. Again, I'm giving away the punchline. We need it to be faster, and the specific data object that we're storing that we want to keep close and fast is a page table entry. It's a very specific size, it's very small, and so what we can do is we can have a special cache called a translation look-aside buffer that stores the mappings for the virtual page numbers that we're currently using. And so the idea here of a TLB, I'll show a more detailed diagram in a minute, is that you have a virtual address, which is a VPN and offset. We take the virtual page number, we look in our TLB, and we get out a physical page number, and then we combine that with the offset. There's no multi-level traversal here. This gives you the direct mapping from the virtual page number that you're accessing directly to the physical page number, so you can immediately now go access the data that you want. No multi-level page table walk. And the TLB can be made small because it only needs to store page table entries, so this might be like 8 bytes wide, and highly associative to reduce misses. And now this will be dramatically faster than having to do your multi-level page table walk, even if everything fits in the L1 cache. So let's compare an L1 cache and a TLB. And I want to make clear that a TLB is a separate structure. In hardware. It's not part of the L1 cache. It is connected to the page table walker, but if you have a hit in the TLB, you don't use the page table walker. The index in an L1 cache is a physical address. The index in the TLB is a virtual page number. What you get in the case of an L1 cache are data bytes. What you get from the TLB on a hit is a page table entry. The size of a block in the cache is 32 to 64 bytes in a real cache. The size of a TLB, as I said, is one page table entry. Even an L1 cache will typically have 512, 1K, 2K blocks toward the higher end of that range in modern processors. A modern TLB might be 64 to 96 entries. And hold that question for 1 minute. I want to remind you that this only caches the last level page table entry. So you directly get the page table entry you need at the end of the page table walk. So this avoids the page table walk. And what's in there is actually you need to have a tag to match the page table entry. There's no tag if it's fully associative. And I want to get down here to this figure. So on a page table hit, we take the entire virtual page number, look in the TLB. If it's a hit, we just split the page table parts, check the valid bit, and then we get our physical page number, combine it with that offset. Boom, we're done. You had a question?
My question was, how do you index into a TLB? Because you mentioned that there's like 96, and presumably this, yeah, just like how you index into it.
So, indexing is similar to a cache. The virtual page number, you divide it into index and tag, just like we say down here. In fact, I don't even need to write that, right? Because it's on the slide. So let me draw a figure instead. So here's our TLB. Here's our virtual page number. And what we're actually going to do is we're going to ignore the offset. So we're only looking at the virtual page number.
And why is it no tag if it's fully associated?
You know what? Thank you.
Index.
Yep. I made that mistake, I think, last on the midterm review, too. But, yep, so you caught that, so you're following. So there's no index because we're checking all of the entries. That looks like an F. So I kind of glossed past these. We don't have multiple page table entries per slice of the cache per block, because there's often not much spatial locality between pages. Maybe there is in particular in the code and segment, because you might be moving around in a function that spans a page boundary, but it ends up not being very effective to try to group group adjacent pages into something like a cache block, the way that we group adjacent words in a regular cache. So we just have every item in the TLB is its own page table entry. And vendors have experimented with fully associative versus not full, but high associativity. And I haven't really followed that literature lately. I think AMD is still doing non-fully associative, and Intel is still doing fully associative, and I don't know what ARM and Apple and so on are doing, but these are things you can Google and find out if you're curious. But you definitely want very high associativity. And because it is very small, you can afford to do that. And actually, in a special case where you're doing fully associative, there are some circuit tricks you can play to make it faster. Question?
So does that mean if there's only one page table geographic block, we don't care for sexuality? Does that mean utilities don't usually have ways?
Well, if we make it associative, we'll have ways. So let's say we have a four-way, I think there's an example in the slides. If you have a TLB that's four-way associative, let's say it's 64 entries and it's four-way associative. So we'll have 16 sets. Each of them will have four entries in the set. And so the virtual page number will map to one of those sets, and we'll check four ways in parallel. And if it's a miss, then we'll use the LRU we'll evict the LRU item from that set, and that's where we'll fill in the missing entry. So in this sense, it's just like a cache. All of the principles apply, except when you index and you have something coming out, it's not a full cache block, it's just one page table entry. So the TLB will be very closely integrated inside the core, just like the L1. And so every core will have an L1i cache, an L1 data cache, and a TLB, all super optimized for speed. And so extraordinary design effort goes into making the TLB as fast as it making the circuit speed be as fast as needed so that it is a single cycle access. And one of the ways that you do that is you make the transistors bigger, so that takes up more die area and it consumes more power. And if you look at a power map of a processor, you will find that the TLBs will be some of the warmer blocks in the hardware design because they're dissipating more power per access. And they're dissipating power at a steady rate because they're being used every single access. And I should have mentioned, there's actually typically a separate TLB for instruction accesses and a separate TLB for data accesses. Most hardware designs do it that way. So we need a TLB to avoid page table walks, and we need to do a translation on every instruction and data access. So we need a TLB, right? We don't we need something that will cache the recently used virtual page number to physical page number translations directly and avoid the multi-level page table walk. So we need that functionality somewhere. And the question was, why not integrate that with the cache? And the reason is basically we need different things out of these structures. It's kind of outlined in this table. So they just need to sort of, the actual hardware structures need to be organized differently. One is sort of tall and skinny. It has, 64 to 96 entries. And it has just page table entries. And if you think about how tall it is, it's actually much smaller than an L1 cache. So if we have, let's say, 64K cache with 64 byte blocks, we're going to have 1K cache blocks in that cache. Whereas our TLB might have, in a really aggressive TLB, up to 128 entries. So we're off by like an order of magnitude. And one of the reasons for that is to make the TLB single cycle and very high associativity, we have to sacrifice capacity. So it goes back to those trade-offs that we looked at earlier. So on a TLB miss, what happens? Then we do our regular page table walk. So we take the first part of the virtual page number. We use that with the page table base register to look in the first level page table. We have to go fetch that from the cache. Hopefully it's a cache hit. Then that will point us to the second level page table. We use a second level page, or the second part of the virtual page number to index that. Hopefully that's a cache hit. And what we get out of there is the actual mapping. And we bring that in from memory and we actually check that it's a valid entry. And if it is, we put that into the TLB, replacing whatever the LRU item is in the appropriate set. And now we have handled our TLB miss. So the actual hardware flow is that every translation checks the TLB. If it's a TLB hit, great, we're good to go. We take the physical page number that we get out of that, combine it with our offset, that's our physical address, we index the cache, we handle cache misses as needed. On a TLB miss, we do our page table walk, we fill the entry that we get into the TLB, assuming it's not like a seg fault, and then we try the load or store again, and now it will be a TLB hit. And that's how the processor handles address translation. So the TLB is actually really fundamental to a processor being effective. Now, very, very low-end, low-performance, low-power processors, like you might have in IoT devices, may not want to spend the area and the power on the TLB. They may not want to spend the area on translation. So they may just get rid of translation altogether and directly use physical addresses and have no mechanism for hardware translation. So that is an acceptable trade-off when you are running basically a single application. That's all that device is doing. And you don't need to support all of the features that make us normally want to have virtual memory. Any questions? All right, so let's do an actual example just to make this a little more concrete. Again, we're going back to sort of toy sizes here so they fit on a slide. So here we have a two-way set associative TLB with, in this case, we have here 3 bits. So 2 to the 3 is 8. So we actually have 8 sets. We're just showing 3 of them. So that's what the dot, dot, dots are for. So we take our virtual page number, we break it up into index and tag bits. The index bits is the log of the number of sets. And then the tag bits are what's left over. And so in this particular address, we have an index of 4. So we would go to the 4th entry. And let's say that's right here. And we would have to check, in this case, both ways, because it's two-way set associative. We have a hit over here. It's valid. So now we can take the physical page number and combine it with the page offset to get our physical address that we're going to use to go to the cache. The TLB actually contains the full page table entry content, so it has to contain information about whether this page is read-only or not, or whether it's writable in this case, whether it's a system reserved for the operating system or whether it's user-level accessible and so on. Because all that permission checking that we talked about for translation has to happen at the TLB before you can actually use that mapping. So the TLB is a complete stand-in for all that multi-level page table walking and page table entry bit processing that we've talked about before. And that all has to happen in one cycle. You still need the page table walker to handle TLB misses. So the exercise that you're doing for your homework is actually what hardware implements. It's just that you hopefully only have to do that page table walk fairly rarely if your TLB is designed well. I don't remember for sure, but I seem to recall that I don't remember if they use true LRU or an approximation. I can't remember off the top of my head. I have this vague recollection from like grad school that there is a special case LRU implementation that works when you have full associativity, but I'm not confident about that. So, because checking 64, 96, 128 entries in parallel is very expensive in circuitry, that's why the TLB is like an order of magnitude fewer entries than a cache. Let's see here. So let's do another exercise here, and this is a pair and share, talk to your neighbor. Now suppose we have a four entry two-way TLB with 4K pages, and LRU replacement, and it's initially empty. So first you're going to want to figure out how many index bits there are versus tag bits. And then you're going to want to figure out what the index is for the virtual address 0x12345. So see if you can work that through. Right. So I just heard somebody saying, and in the interest of time, I'm just going to jump in. So these three hex digits will be your offset, right? So this is 12-bit offset, right? So that means the low three hex digits are your offset. So then this is your virtual page number. we have a four-entry two-way. So that means we have two sets. So that means we have one index bit to choose between option 0 and option 1. So it'll be whatever the least significant bit here is of the virtual page number. And so if this were an 8-entry two-way TLB, we would have 4 sets, and so we would have 2 bits of index, and so on. All right, so now let's do an exercise and think about which are TLB hits, which are TLB misses, and what the final contents of the TLB are if the TLB starts out empty. So for example, we know that the first entry is going to be a compulsory miss, right? So let me show just a little bit here. So for the first couple, you're gonna ignore the low 3 hex digits just like before, right? So you're only gonna be looking at this hex digit, and you're only going to be looking at the least significant bit of that because there's only 2 sets. set 0 and set 1. So basically, is this hex digit odd or even? Is a kind of shortcut way to think about it. So in the case of 0x440, since the cache is cold, since the TLB is cold, obviously the first one is going to be a miss, and then the second one is accessing the same page, so of course that's going to be a hit. And then when we go to 0xFFFE008, again, we ignore the low 3, so we look at E, which is happens to be even as well. So it is going to also go into this set 0 in the other way, right? Because it's two-way. But when we go to the next reference to FFFE, it's of course a hit. And when we go to FFFD here, D is odd. So it'll go to set 1. So that's going to be a miss. Everyone with me so far? So let's... Do people want a little more time to look at the remaining examples, the bottom 3, or should we just dive in? Okay, so here's the rest of it. Ignore the low 3 because those are offset. We're going to be looking at 4 here. That's even, so that is going to have to... replace whatever the LRU item is in this set. So that's going to replace 0x440. It's a miss. Then we go back to 0x440. It just got kicked out, so it's a miss. And this is the LRU, so it replaces that. And then we come back to FFFD, and that's a hit. Any questions so far? Yeah. Sorry, I didn't hear.
Does the read versus write, like type of, you know, what you're trying to do matter for this at all?
So important question that I neglected to cover. Thank you for bringing that up. So the question for the recording was, does it matter whether this is a read or a write? And in the case of the TLB for hit or miss, it does not matter. However, you do need that information to determine whether it is a legal access or an illegal access, right? So if you're trying to write to a read-only page, even if it's a hit, you should not proceed with that mapping. That would be a seg fault. Because what's actually stored in there, in addition to the tag and the physical page that corresponds to this entry, as we mentioned earlier, is all the other permission bits that go with that page table entry that you have to check. So not only is it valid, but is it writable if this is a write access? Is it user accessible if this is user level code running, et cetera? Any other questions? Yeah. Valid. So I think what you're going to ask, maybe, I'll mention it anyway because it's relevant, is this valid bit coming from the page table that you got from the page table? This is the valid bit for the TLB entry. So if we have a valid page table entry here with a mapping for a particular virtual to physical mapping, then the valid bit will be set. Of course, a prerequisite for that is that we were able to successfully read an entry from the page table walk in order to be able to put it into the TLB. We never put something in the TLB if the page table walk fails. Any other questions? All right, so that finishes our sorry, I've got a tickle in my throat and I'm out of my drink, but we only have a few minutes to go. So we're done with caches, we're done with page tables, we're done with virtual memory. As far as lecture is concerned, of course, you're not done with your homework until you turn in page table 3. But we're ready to start a new topic in lecture, and that is threads and concurrent programming. So we talked a little bit about threads toward the beginning of the semester and the notion of what threads represent in a process. So we have what we might call a heavyweight process, which is the whole address space of a process. And then we can have different threads of control that share the address space, but each thread of control has its own program counter, its own registers, and its own stack. Now, why would we want to have different threads of control in a single process? And so the reasons are for concurrency, so that you can be doing multiple things at once. This is super useful if you have multiple cores, but it is even useful if you just have a single core and you have to keep context switching these threads. So imagine my favorite example, Word, and you've got this spell checker running in the background. So you're typing away, and you also want to have the spell checker running in the background. You don't want the typing, the interactivity, to freeze while it's doing a spell check. You want that to be a separate thread of control. At the same time, most of the time your typing is slow enough that it can interleave, it can actually do a context switch for the input part of Word, load the spell check thread, do a little bit of spell checking, and as soon as you hit a key, bring back the user input thread, process that user input, then when there's a pause in the typing, do some more spell checking, and so on. So even with a single core, multi-threading is useful. But of course, if you have multiple cores, which is cell phones, laptops, they all have multiple cores. These can actually be happening on different cores simultaneously. So in a case like this, what the threads allow you to do is to allow different things to be happening at once. Input and spell checking. Input and spell checking and grammar checking. Well, et cetera, et cetera. Or in the case of a web server, you might want to have one thread that is listening to the network interface, waiting for a new web request to come in. And then as soon as a web request comes in, there's a thread processing that request while you have another thread waiting for the next web request. You wouldn't want the web server to freeze until it finishes processing a web request, and only then accept a new network input. That would really reduce the throughput of your web server. And so web servers are multi-threaded. Another example is when you have work that is sort of more directly parallelizable. So you can chop up the work into pieces and do each of these pieces in parallel on different cores. For that to be useful, you pretty much do need multiple cores. So the example is kind of at the top, allowing different things to happen at once, especially when we're supporting some I/O processing, like in the Word or the web server example, and doing some stuff with that input. That can benefit from threads even with a single core, but let's say we have a matrix multiply. We can chop that matrix up into quadrants or, you know, as many pieces as we have cores and do each of those in parallel simultaneously, however many cores we have. And so you will actually do an assignment where you do exactly this. Instead of matrix multiply, we have a different matrix-based task. It's called the game of life. We'll it's talked about in the write-up, but the basic idea is you've got a grid of cells. Each cell represents a potential location for like a bacterium, and whether in each time step that bacterium lives or dies is a function of its neighbors. So if it has too many neighbors that are competing for food, then a cell dies. And so there are various rules that you can apply, and it has actually proven to be a fairly useful modeling framework for a bunch of really meaningful real-world phenomena. It happens to be a very natural parallelizable algorithm, where for every element in your matrix, you compute some value of your neighbors. And what particularly makes this interesting is when you divide it into pieces, like quadrants, you will have some edge effects that you have to worry about, right? So if a cell is a function of its neighbors, and you've sliced your matrix, along the edges, a cell is going to want data from a different quadrant where the values are being computed on a different core. How do you know when those values are ready? You can't just grab whatever values in memory anytime you want. You have to actually wait for it to be produced. So not only do we have parallelism, but we have to deal with synchronization. In this case, producer-consumer synchronization of some type. And this becomes the foundation for a set of important concepts in today's world where essentially all processes are multi-core. All the code that you're going to have to write is going to need to be multi-threaded. All the code that you get an LLM to generate when you're in a job and you're actually using LLMs for code generation, you're going to have to understand what makes for safe, correct, concurrent execution and synchronization so that you can debug the mistakes that that LLM makes. And so what we will study here is the basic concepts of concurrent programming, synchronization, and some of the problems that happen, like deadlock. So if you have one thread waiting for, so you have A waiting for B to produce a value, but B can't do anything until A produces a value, you have deadlock. They're waiting on each other, and neither of them can move forward until the other does something, but they can't do something because they're waiting on the other one. So you also have to be careful not to write code that deadlocks. So let me just close with this picture. So just a reminder, a single-threaded process will look like this, where, you know, here's all the state on the left that we talked about. This is what's inherited when you copy fork and when you copy on a fork. Now with a multi-threaded process, we share some global state like the overall address space, the heap, the data segment, files, PID, the code segment, but every thread has its own stack, its own registers, its own program counter, which means its own way to sort of go through the code independently of the other threads. And this is a multi-threaded process. Sometimes you'll hear the term heavyweight process and lightweight process. All right, that's a good stopping point. Thanks, everyone. Good luck with the page table assignment.